Und herzlich willkommen bei der vermutlich letzten Veranstaltung des Jahres von Jacobin Magazine. Ich freue mich, dass mal wieder so viele erschienen sind. Ja, ich bin Lauren Ballhorn. Einige von euch werden mich bestimmt kennen. Ich bin der Chefredakteur von Jacobin und wir versammeln uns heute Abend, um unsere neue Ausgabe zu markieren und auch natürlich das Jahresende zu zelebrieren. Wir werden dieses Jahr, tut mir leid, ich habe auch bereits ein paar sehr enttäuschte Nachrichten bekommen, aber kein Quiz machen dieses Jahr. Aber dafür wird es nächstes Jahr umso besser, versprochen. Sondern wir werden heute Abend diskutieren über die Ausgabe. Wir haben heute zwei fantastische Gäste mit uns. Direkt neben mir meine Kollegen aus der Redaktion, Astrid Zimmermann. Weit rechts von mir stehend, aus meiner Perspektive, weit links aus eurer Perspektive und sicherlich auch aus ihrer Perspektive, Kristin Gazi. Kristin ist. Kristin ist momentan Fellow am Einstein-Forum in Potsdam, ist auch Professorin an der University of Pennsylvania, wenn ich mich richtig entsinne, und ist auch die Autorin von vielen fantastischen Büchern. Ein paar davon gibt es auch draußen zu kaufen, unter anderem, warum Frauen im Sozialismus besseren Sex hatten, haben und haben werden. Das leitet auch ein bisschen zum Thema über der neuen Ausgabe. Unsere neue Ausgabe geht weder um den Sozialismus des 20. Jahrhunderts, noch um den Sozialismus des 21. Jahrhunderts, noch um warum wir sozialistische Parteien aufbauen müssen, sondern wir haben mal ein anderes Thema entdeckt, und zwar die Liebe. Und zwar, genau, die beiden werden gleich viel mehr darüber zu sagen haben als ich, aber der Gedanke dabei war ein bisschen, dass das Thema Liebe in den letzten Jahren gefühlt immer mehr von Rex besetzt wird, sei es in Form von Tradwives im Internet, aber auch vor allem im anglophonen Raum, aber auch hierzulande, wie Politiker der AfD und der CDU über den Zerfall der Familie sprechen, über die Männlichkeitskrise, die Einsamkeitskrise sprechen. Und wir dachten, eigentlich müsste man auch von links dieses Thema wieder besetzen, weil wir der Meinung sind, dass Liebe nicht nur die Grundlage von jeder guten Beziehung ist. Darüber haben wir uns auch ein bisschen gestritten, aber ich bleibe dabei. Jede gute Beziehung muss Liebe als Fundament haben, sondern auch das Fundament von jeder solidarischen und sozialistischen Gesellschaftsordnung. Und zwei fantastischen Autorinnen sitzen hier mit mir heute Abend, um über ihre Artikel im Heft zu diskutieren. Gut, damit würde ich wechseln. Nochmal, Kristin, Astrid, thanks for joining us this evening. I'm sure you have a lot of other things you could be doing as well, and we're really glad you chose to spend your time with us. Both of you have pretty long, significant articles in the new issue, the topic of which is love, in case there's anyone out there who doesn't speak German. I'd like to start actually with you, Astrid, because you wrote the opening article in the issue. The title of your article is The Freedom to Care, and I will kümmern in German. Maybe we could just start out by having you unpack that title and that word care a little bit. What do you mean by care? What is the freedom to care? And is caring the same as loving? Or is there a begriffliche Unterscheidung there?
I'm not really sure if I can answer that. I mean, because this is, I mean, very, like, almost philosophical question to define what love is, and I don't really think I can do this because it's so personal and kind of, like, subjective how people experience love and how they express love, but I guess what maybe, you know, we can all agree on is the people that you love the most are the ones you care for the most, the ones you care about the most, so those are the ones you prioritize in your lives, those are the ones you are the most, like, generous with your time, your affection, your attention, your energy, all of these things, because you have a genuine self-interest in their well-being. And I guess this is where I feel like it turns into like a political or a societal question, because it begs the question how free we are in sort of following this impulse to, you know, share our time, our affection, our energy as generously as we want to. And if we look at our current societies, we have, despite everything that the government is saying about, you know, German workers are being lazy and they want too much like work-life balance and whatever, we have collectively never worked as much as we have now. We have, so people are spending more time, they're working longer, they're working harder, they need more time to simply, time and energy to simply secure their economic survival. And I think that if you do this, but you know, people aren't working this hard, they're working this much because they want to move up in society because this is not working anymore because their economy is broken, they're working this hard to simply prevent their economic downfall. If you add to this like a general sense of economic insecurity, we're living through a recession year after year, we're being told we have to tighten our belts, we have to cut more, there's going to be cuts in social spending. I think that if this happens year after year, I don't think it's a coincidence that in this sort of like social climate, this feeling of like general scarcity kind of topples over into the social realm, which I feel like is what is happening right now. Because if all of your energy and your time is being consumed by securing your economic survival, you're going to, at the end of the day, have very little time and energy left for anything else, for example, your relationships, because they're you're consumed, you're overly exhausted. And I guess this is kind of what I mean when I talk about there's a lack of freedom that people don't really have sovereignty over deciding in their everyday lives how free they are, how much do they want to prioritize relationships in their lives, because we actually live in a system that makes this decision for us, because it tells us spend as little time and energy as possible on your relationships, because if you do, you actually risk a lot. The people that care the most in our societies are the ones that lose the most, because they do this, they lose financial security, they lose their economic independence, they lose their future employability, for example. And so I think then it's natural that maybe relationships and the kind of responsibilities that come with them are perceived to be like personal liability almost. And that I think maybe this is the connection why we feel like this is sort of like impoverishment of social life. Because we can't freely care as much as we want to. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how does that jive? I mean, that's, does that cut against the narrative that we at Jacobin have certainly endorsed, but I think it's pretty widespread on the left in terms of our critique of neoliberalism, what Nancy Fraser would call progressive neoliberalism, or in German is oftentimes called regressive modernization, that kind of the essence of late stage capitalism or whatever you want to call. I fear it's not very late stage, unfortunately, but our contemporary moment that capital doesn't care who you love, how you love, when you love, as long as you sell your labor power for the right price?
I mean, I guess I don't disagree with this thesis, but I think if you look at relationships, it kind of complicates this thesis, because if we say, okay, you know, we in our private lives, we can love whom we want, we can care for whom we want, we can do this however we please, this is sort of confined to the realm of our personal freedom, I think it kind of masks how intrusive late-stage capitalism actually governs almost all of our aspects, all of the aspects of our lives. Because, of course, you know, like norms over relationships and gender and sexuality, they've changed over the past decades, which is a good thing. But I mean, just because there's a growing consensus that the genders should be equal, relationship models should be equal, that doesn't mean that they are actually equal, because they're not, and we all know that they're not. If, I don't know, for example, you're married, you're going to be, you know, eligible for tax cuts that other people in other relationship models might not be eligible for, or if, say, you're a government like the current German government that wants to convince people that we need very draconian social welfare cuts, you're gonna tell people that it's not actually the state's responsibility to provide the support because you want to privatize the support. And so you're gonna tell people this should be, you know, you should either rely on your family or rely on your spouse. This is sort of like the first, Zelle, the first, of social care and solidarity, like the unit. This is sort of like the primary unit of solidarity, right? And by doing this, you obviously produce a hierarchy among different relationship models, and it allows you to basically say, if you're not able to secure yourselves within like a traditional marriage model or a traditional family model, then maybe you're not deserving of that social security and you're not deserving of that care. And that's precisely what the government is doing right now. When, for example, they say, oh, we've lived beyond our means. We have this really excessive welfare state, and therefore we have to cut now. We have to cut at the what's called Grundsicherung. And if you then look at who's actually among the largest recipient of this form of like unemployment benefit, the largest, second largest group is single moms, for example. So essentially what you're saying, if you as a woman decide you want to raise a child by yourself, this government has decided that this is a kind of like care model that we deem to be unworthy of support, and therefore we're going to cut as harsh as possible. And I think if you look at these sort of like societal circumstances, it shows how we're actually not really free in making these decisions, even though, you know, late stage capitalism presents itself as those sort of like very like libertarian in this way and actually does not care as long as you said, yeah, you sell your labor power.
I would like to come back to the, oh man, here we go. The freedom to care and also the current attacks on our freedom to care in Germany. But I also want to give Kristen a chance to speak. So Astrid said that she is not sure that she can give us a definition of love because it's a bit of a philosophical question. Kristen, your essay in the new issue is maybe an attempt to construct a political economic definition of love. And you distinguish between use and exchange values of love. Now, I can, you know, like, a little bit of experience, I think I can kind of, you know, more or less imagine what the use value of love is. But maybe you could break down what you mean by use and exchange value of love in whatever late stage capitalism or whatever capitalism we live in.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, one of the things when we do a materialist analysis is to think about this distinction between what use something has in the real world and then how it gets commodified and the commodification of use values into exchange values. Obviously, this is something that both Marx and Engels spent a lot of time thinking about, as did people like Alexander Kollontai, who is a great influence on myself and my own work. And so in order to really think concretely about how to do a materialist analysis of something like love, which is fundamentally immaterial, I wanted to kind of try to break it down. And in the article, I talk about affection and attention, and then this third thing, which I'm sort of provisionally calling reciprocal flow. And it's not to say that love consists only of those three things, but it consists of at least those three things. And attention and affection are affective resources that are very easily commodifiable, in the sense that algorithms are constantly trying to take our attention. We are living in a society where attention, the attention that we either give away or that we buy, is sold in units very much like labor power is sold. And I also think that's true for affection. So attention is just the idea of paying attention to somebody, looking them in the eye and making them feel valuable, listening to their thoughts and opinions, giving them the kind of validation that we all really need as human beings. that's the use value of love, but it's very easily commodifiable, this attention. And in fact, I think because when we talk about the attention economy, or somebody like Shoshana Zuboff talks about the age of surveillance capitalism, what she's talking about is the commodification of attention. I think most of us intuitively have a feeling for how attention can very easily be sold and bought on a market. Affection is a little bit different, right? It's not just this attentiveness, but it's actually what we think of as touch and pampering and caressing and cuddling, all the things that we do with the people that we love, the people that we care for in our lives. And that also has increasingly been commodified. It's always been commodified on some level because there is an affection, perhaps, deficit. It's a very desired commodity, and it's a commodity that people are willing to pay for. But, you know, outside of the sort of obvious example of something like sex work, we also just think of various forms of pampering, getting your nails done, getting your hair done, getting a massage, having foot reflexology, right? There are all sorts of ways in which we can be desirous and acquirous of affection, and also we can sell units of affection. And so both of those things are very easily commodifiable by capital. But the third aspect of love, of what I'm theorizing in some ways, is this thing called reciprocal flow. And I have to say, in the special issue, the illustrations are absolutely gorgeous. Whoever the artist is, yeah, to try to beautifully represent what I mean by reciprocal flow. And reciprocal flow is fundamentally this natural exchange of affection and attention in a way that is ultimately uncommodifiable. Because the minute you drag reciprocal flow into the market, it ceases to be reciprocal flow. So the example that I give in the issue is like if you're at a pride parade, for instance, and somebody has a sign that says free hugs, but at the same time they've got a can out and they're taking donations, it sort of undermines the idea that these are free hugs. So capital doesn't know what to do with reciprocal flow. It can't commodify it in the way that it can attention and affection. And so what it does in many respects is to diminish its value and to try to convince us that being in a state of reciprocal flow with our loved ones is somehow a weakness. It's somehow something that we should avoid. So we very hastily, you know, get out of toxic friendships or toxic relationships whenever we feel as if some kind of transactionality in our relationships isn't being properly acknowledged and reciprocated, we should break off. And I think that as leftists, we have to understand that the key mode of capitalism is to try to change as many use values into exchange values. That's how capitalism thrives. That's like when we think about modern capitalism, it's no longer just about labor and labor power. It's not just about commodities. It's also about these immaterial things like attention and affection that get dragged into the market. And when there's something that cannot be commodified, it becomes irrelevant or diminished or even actively sort of demonized in our discussions of value. And yet, we've all experienced reciprocal flow. Reciprocal flow is sort of a fundamental way in which nature works, the wonderful work of somebody like Robin Wall Kimmerer, who talks about, she has a wonderful new book called The Serviceberry, and the ways in which, you know, trees lose their leaves and the leaves rot into the ground and nourish the roots of the trees. And there's this beautiful cyclical way that nature, systemic equilibria are maintained by reciprocal flow. And we're losing it because it can't be commodified. Now, there are circumstances where it can be, and or it can be discursively created as a place where labor can be extracted, but that's a separate kind of question. But the key thing is that reciprocal flow has an incredibly powerful use value, but it has no exchange value. And because the moment we drag this concept, this feeling, this, you know, wonderful back and forth, this beautiful rhythmic dynamic of giving and receiving into the market, it's no longer what it is. And that, I think, is at the root of our care crisis. It is at the root of why love as an emotion is a deeply and profoundly political project, and why we have to resist the market and reframe the market and push these different ideas of exchange value as being the only worths, like the worthwhile things in our lives. We should actually stop and think, what are the things that we value in our lives that don't have exchange values, that we value for their use value alone, and to return to a world where we really think about love as something that has probably the most important use value, but needs to be ultimately protected from the commodification of the market.
Well, that links right up with my next question. You mentioned examples like foot reflexology or whatever it was called, or other commodified forms of attention and affection. And I mean, anyone who was around the online left 10 years ago probably had plenty of debates on sex work and is it work, is it not? And you know, that's one debate that I tend to think is a little toxic, to use your language, and I'd rather not get into. But I would, is not the implication of your analysis that this kind of commodification or whatever kind of affection, attention, these are things that we would seek to transcend in a socialist society?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that to come back to something that Astrid was just saying, right, if you are exhausted and you are working two jobs, maybe three jobs, hustling to just meet your basic economic needs, the exchange value of attention and affection increase dramatically. And so we can see it in contemporary capitalist societies where wealthy people purchase an incredible amount of attention and affection because they can afford to. Being leisured, being pampered is a way of performing privilege in our societies. And so I do absolutely believe that in societies where people have more time and proximity, because those are the two sort of pieces that make reciprocal flow possible, if we were living in societies where we had a kind of much higher basis for our collective understanding of what basic needs and care would look like, there would be far less incentives. Like the difference between the use value and exchange value of attention and affection would be far less. So that doesn't mean that it wouldn't exist. Of course it would. It always has. It probably always will on some level. But fewer people would be compelled to commodify their attention and affection, and fewer people would be desirous of purchasing it on a market because they would have it naturally in the society that they lived in, because we would all have more time and leisure to care for the people in our lives. And, you know, I think it's really important to talk about love and care in Marxist terms, because one of the things that the right wing has done really well is to kind of co-opt a language of care and co-opt a language of love to say that somehow if we move back to the past to some traditional fantasy of what family life was like in the 50s, we would be more loving and caring of each other. And in fact, it's a complete fantasy. There's a beautiful book by Stephanie Kuntz called The Way We Never Were, which is like exactly unpacking this fantasy that somehow we were in more loving family and friendship relationships in the 50s. I think that what leftists can offer really powerfully to people in 2025 and going forward is a world in which we are all subsumed in lateral relations of care and support that make our lives comfortable and meaningful and truly powerfully connected to each other. Because we live in an age of incredible social isolation and loneliness, and that's just going to get worse as we continue to commodify attention and affection, and fewer members of our society can afford to purchase those resources.
I'd definitely like to talk more about the implications for your analysis for politics, for socialist politics. But before that, I want to go back to the zeitgeist, so to speak. We have two articles in the issue, both Astrid's as well as another article by Julia Wertmann, that discuss a phenomenon that, frankly, I had not heard of before Astrid brought it up at our first meeting to plan this issue, something called heteropessimism, which I don't know, I guess I'm lucky to be in a happy relationship. I don't have to think about these things, but a growing discursive phenomenon, at least, within feminist circles of sort of a resignation from heterosexual relationships, a resignation, or at least from committed long-term relationships. And I think we can see, I wouldn't call it a pendant necessarily, but we also have right-wing phenomena like incels, guys who spend a lot of time alone by themselves on the internet. I was frankly not familiar with this feminist discourse that is kind of the point of departure for your article. So I'd be interested to hear a little bit your thoughts on where that phenomenon is coming from and what it says about the society we live in right now.
I mean, what I think is interesting with this concept was when I read, there's an essay, Asa Sarasin, I hope I pronounced that correctly. They coined the term in an essay a couple of years ago, and if you read it, you might expect, okay, so this is going to be about, you know, mainly, I don't know, sexualized violence, like unequal, you know, women doing the majority of reproductive labor, all of this stuff, and that there's sort of like an understandable kind of like rage or resentment and therefore kind of reluctance to enter a heterosexual relationship. And then you read it and you realize a lot of the essay is about embarrassment. So it's more like, it's talking a lot about the fact that ultimately, if you're like a progressive, politically minded woman or you're a feminist, the most embarrassing thing you could do right now is to like men or to want to be liked by men. It's just incredibly embarrassing, really, really lame. And because what you're doing is you're kind of expressing a desire for something that is doomed to be a disappointment. It can only go wrong. This is sort of the whole vibe. It's less about like, okay, we're really, really angry because the society is so persistent to change. It's just like a guilty pleasure, kind of like an unfortunate accident in your life is your sexual orientation, which is kind of, And so I think when you, try to understand like where this is coming from, I do think that it is a symptom of political resignation at the end of the day, because I mean, for the longest time, the idea was what we have to do is we have to free women or emancipate them or ourselves from relationships that are oppressive, that are unequal, that are violent. But it hasn't worked in the last decades. And so I think maybe then the sort of like discursive term is if we're unable to free ourselves from these repressive relationships, we're just going to free ourselves from relationships altogether. So then you're just better off alone, because if you're alone, you can also rid yourself of all of the obligations and responsibilities that come with relationships, because they're often also work if you feel committed to someone. And so I think in that way, it also ties to what we talked about earlier, the sort of like really pervasive sense of exhaustion that people feel. So of course, I mean, there's also an entire sort of like online discourse where you just see people like coming home to their apartments that are completely empty, they're completely alone, and they're just like in a sort of like very meditative state, cleaning their apartments, doing their skincare. It looks incredibly relaxing. Like I understand the appeal of this, or like people upload kind of like pictures of themselves. This is how I looked like before I entered a relationship. They're sort of like exuberant and happy and glowing and beautiful, and then they're like 5 years in and they're sort of like drained. It seems like all of the energy is drained out of them and they're exhausted. And so I do think at the end of the day, it is still exhaustion that is the underlying kind of catalyst for this feeling. Because if you're so exhausted, the idea that the only care you have to take on is taking care of yourself, sort of like individualized care, is really, you know, seems like it's a more realistic coping strategy to deal with exhaustion than trying to wait for a social change that is you perceive to be unrealizable. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question. But.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question for both of you, but maybe we'll stick with you first, Astrid, because you also had an article one or two issues ago about the phenomenon of rising domestic violence and violence against women, even in situations where women's income share, for example, is increasing, where objective material conditions for women are arguably, not only arguably, but objectively better than they were 40, 50, 60 years ago. So what are the political implications of that for us, right, as the left, at a time when, as you mentioned in the beginning, you know, the government is cutting social services, is attacking social spending, attacking pensions. Do we just, as the left, give the same robust defense of the welfare state as always, or do we have to think beyond it? And I can imagine Kristen also has a lot of thoughts on this, but what do you think first?
I mean, this is a really difficult question, because also in the article I was trying to like just bring up that there's, you know, sort of like an analytical gap or something that seems like really like hesitant to answer. I mean, I think for one, we should definitely stop trying to like scold and shame people for their like private lifestyle decisions, because apparently this doesn't work really well. So however you feel about it, there's still going to be a sizable share of the population that finds the idea of having companionship, maybe even starting a family, as just putting it out there, as a goal in their life. They find this really desirable, and I don't think it helps if we just tell them and scold them from them this is really lame and embarrassing, and that they should just like find something else that they find fulfilling in their lives. Because as Kristen also said, if we do this, we kind of run the risk, I think, of having the right to jump in and in their own way respond to that need by saying, oh, do you feel lonely? Well, of course you feel lonely, because supposedly it's all of these feminists that, you know, want to abolish the family and they want to end romance, and therefore you feel so isolated and alone and alienated. And do you maybe feel that your communities are disintegrating and, you know, your social life isn't functioning anymore? Of course, that's also the fault of the leftists, because they let in all of these immigrants and kind of like foreign intruders that disrupt our communities. And we're going to be here to protect your relationships, protect your family, protect your communities. And I think this is really dangerous if we don't have an answer that sort of like speaks to people's need for like sociability, for companionship, for community, and simply tell them to sort of like try to emancipate themselves out of this need. I think it's a really like alienating message you can give to people. And I do think we have better answers. With the question of violence, I think I have to like marinate on that a bit more, because I to this day don't have the answer. It was mostly me being out of answers myself.
Kristen, you also mentioned how the right, plays on atrophying social ties, a feeling of a loss of community, and if we look at the election of Donald Trump in the country that you and I are so lucky to have grown up in, I think especially in the second term, or his second victory, rather more so 2024 than 2016, that really did play a role for a lot of his supporters. The feeling that our communities are dying, and the left in the form of the Democrats doesn't give a shit. What do you think can be a left response to that feeling that doesn't, tack towards what we would call like a blue labor strategy? So basically just conceding a lot of ground to the right to to try to convince them, people to vote for us anyway. What is a proper left response?
Right, and so here I really think we need to go back to the late 19th and early 20th centuries and reread the work of people like Friedrich Engels and August Bebel and Alexander Kollontai and Clara Zetkin, who were really doing a proper Marxist, you know, dialectical materialist analysis of relationships, particularly Kollontai. And Kollontai spends a lot of time in this wonderful essay called Make Way for Winged Eros, discussing what socialist love would look like, what socialism can offer us in our relationships. And what she says very clearly is that capitalism as a system requires the bourgeois nuclear family because it is this institution which allows for the intergenerational transfer of wealth and privilege from largely fathers to their legitimate children. And because of the isolation of the nuclear family, that is also what allows and generates incredible and persistent levels of inequality in society. So if we look at the contemporary landscapes within which we live, particularly in the United States, but I would say globally, we're in an era of increasing inequality, extreme inequality. And we fail, I think, on the left, in my opinion, to acknowledge that the role that the heterosexual family in particular and the way that our governments and societies freight our romantic relationships with the responsibility for the production, care, and upbringing of the next generation of consumers, taxpayers, soldiers, whatever, you know, huh? Workers, exactly. So when you go back and you read somebody like Kollontai, what she says is, if we lived in a more socialistic society, we would have a broader network of ties. We would be able to share our affective resources so much more generously with our comrades, our colleagues, our neighbors, our families. It would be so much easier to have a romantic relationship, A, because the work of raising the next generation would be distributed more socially, and B, individual heterosexual relationships, and this is the early 20s, the last century, she's primarily talking about heterosexual relationships, would not be freighted with the entire responsibility of raising the next generation and of reproducing capitalist levels of privilege. So I feel like, as the left, one of the things that we have to say is that socialist societies would be more loving. They would be more connected. We would have more friends, more parties. We would have greater families. We would, this is a promise. Yes, it's great if we have democratic workplaces. It's great if the workers own the means of production. But it's also really great if we're all having better sex and we're hanging with our friends, right? I mean, why isn't that a message that I understand why, you know, like nobody's gonna win, right? The mayoralty of New York or Berlin on like, we're all gonna have better sex next year. But maybe we would, right? But I think, you know, if I put on my social scientific hat here for a second, there's empirical evidence that supports this. Right, we know from sociological surveys, for instance, that were done in Germany in 1991. Also, we can compare societies like Austria and Hungary. And we can actually concretely see that when people have their basic needs met, time for sociality increases. We have more time to spend with our friends. We have more time to sleep on the weekends. We have more time to relax with our children. We have more times to like roll around in bed with our partners. Whatever it is we want to do, the fundamental basis of our society should not be commerce, it should be care. And that's a message that I understand that for some leftists sounds a little bit too feminine or girly or soft, but it's as important a message as the other kinds of social welfare state policies that are very, very important. And I'm not denying their importance.
Kind of the necessary precondition
for what
you're
describing? They're absolutely necessary preconditions. And if you go back and you read Engels and you read Bebel and you read Kollontai and Zetkin and these early theorists, they're very much arguing that you cannot have a socialist revolution in the public sphere without a concomitant revolution in the private sphere.
Honestly, I think we're going to leave it at that. I think it was a very strong conclusion. Stick around. We got plenty of time to discuss the provocative or maybe very welcome theses brought out on the stage. If you want to check out The Issue to read both Astrid and Kristen's articles and many others, you can buy it up front by the Glühwein stand. And I hope you found the inputs very inspiring, but if you try, just decide to act on some of the things Kristen just described, you know, maybe take it outside. Thanks to all of you for coming. Happy holidays, and yeah.
Thanks for coming.